The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen. Volkswagen.ie.
Good afternoon on this Tuesday afternoon. How are you? 51551 for those text thingamajigs, or you can send us an email to ray@rte.ie. Dr. Michael Mosley is on the show today. He has a new book, The Fast 800. How to combine rapid weight loss and intermittent fasting for long-term health. And he was the man who brought us the 5-2 diet. And some people swear by it. I've never tried it myself. But you do 5 days of normal healthy eating and then you fast for 2 days. Well, now he's introducing this where you're fasting nearly all the time. You're on 800 calories a day. And the health benefits of it are outlined in the book and he will talk us through them. And there's loads of them. There's loads of them. And I must talk to him as well about Dr. Eva Orsman's new book, because she claims she can reverse diabetes. And I think he will agree with that because that could be done with his diets. And we'll be talking to him. We'll be talking to Jen Hogan about the loneliness of being a first-time mum. And after 4 o'clock, I'm interested in this because I think more people out there, particularly adults, can't swim than will admit to not being able to swim, if you know what I mean. And it's odd that we are an island nation and so many people can't swim and so many people don't like fish. Anyways, Blondie Coffey is one of the people, one of the adults in Ireland who can't swim. And she is going to swimming lessons. I don't think this is her first time. I think she's tried before but failed. She can tell you herself her age. I won't do that. She shouldn't do that. It'd be very rude. But anyway, Blondie's going to be in after 4 o'clock and she's going to talk us through how she's getting on with the swimming and why she hasn't learned to swim up until now. And maybe if you have stories about that, you might share them with us and we'll talk to Blondie about them after 4 o'clock. On the Michael Mosley thing, you know, like there is a lot of talk. It is January about losing weight and taking up hobby, taking up exercise, all that sort of thing. And I spotted an article in the London Times on Saturday, and a lot of people spotted it as well. It was on wellness. Have you joined the cult of wellness? They have. Once wellness meant not being ill, now it's a lifestyle choice and devotees take ever more extreme measures in pursuit of optimum health. So just how far do they go to achieve peak zen? And it's an article by Jesse Hewitson. And there's four people, Tim, Alexander, Madeline, and what's the other girl's name? Dasha. Like people slag me off. And I know Mario Rosenstock ridicules me about eating porridge and going for a run and all that sort of thing. But I am in the halfpenny place compared to these people. I'll give you just a sample of some of their quotes. These are people who are heavy into their fitness and wellness and health. So Tim, age 39, while I have my daily morning coffee, I note my weight, my urine pH and how many hours slept, all on a spreadsheet. Now he doesn't have an illness or anything. He's not following all those things because he's just doing it. So he keeps track of all those things in the morning before he goes out to work. Alexander's 38. He's a model and he does something else as well. One of his quotes is, I've an activated charcoal shot. Now, what's an activated charcoal shot? Between work meetings and apple cider vinegar tablets before meals. Because seemingly they suppress your appetite. Then there's Madeline. Madeline's 33. What does Madeline do? I'll just have a look there. A freelance journalist who lives in North London with her husband. The first thing I do when I wake is use my copper tongue scraper. I brush my teeth, then have a shot of live bacteria. So the first thing she does when she wakes up in the morning is scrape her tongue with a copper scraper. Copper tongue scraper, right? And then there's Dasha. And my favourite quote from her is, at 10 a.m. I will take 15 different supplements. I used to take 30, but I've cut down. Now she's not ill, she's well. 15 supplements. And the other Dasha one is, what does she, yeah. I lie on a bed of nails, a plastic studded acupressure mat for 5 minutes each day. And then they've all sorts of Himalayan magnetic lamps and all sorts of goggles they wear to keep out blue light. I don't know if it's online. You should read it anyway. Tis mad. Easy, no, none of them have children. There's too much time on their hands. Gillette, this is interesting. This is interesting. You know, the best the man can get. They have a new ad. It's 2 minutes long. It's more of a, I don't know, it's more of a campaign than an ad. So they're replacing the best a man can get with the best men can be. And Gillette say that it wants men to hold each other accountable. So in the wake of the whole Me Too movement and the justifiable bad press that men have got over the last few years, they have this ad encouraging men to be more thoughtful. Encouraging men, I suppose, to be less like men, less like the traditional roles that men were forced to play. You know, the boys will be boys. That's one of the quotes in it. Well, boys don't have to be boys. And then the way they treated women and all that. So it's 2 minutes of asking men to take a look at their behaviour and maybe change it, which I think is a good thing. It's had 2 million YouTube hits in 48 hours and it's currently on 23,000 likes but 214 dislikes. Now, I read some of the comments underneath it. The dislikes are mainly from men. In less than 2 minutes, you managed to alienate your biggest sales group for your product. Well done, Gillette, says one. And then, of course, people misread it. They get the wrong end of the stick. They think they're having a go at all men, but they're not. They're just pointing out that some men behave in these ways for certain reasons. And if we show better example to the boys in our lives, that won't happen in future generations. I think that's the message. It was directed by Kim Gehrig, a woman. She's UK-based. She also directed the 2015 campaign for Sport England, This Girl Can. And Gillette has partnered with Building a Better Man project, which seeks to reduce violent behaviour in men. I am all suspicious of profit-making organisations who get behind a social issue or a social campaign. I just question their motives because predominantly their motive is to make money. And of course, razor sales, blade sales have gone down over the last while because of the whole hipster thing and people growing beards, etc. Here's the clip from it. Anyway, you can make your own mind up. It's there to watch. And it's the most talked about thing on Twitter at the moment.
To say the right thing. To act the right way.
Bro, not cool, not cool.
Some already are. In ways big.
Yo, men, for everyone.
And small.
I am strong.
I am strong.
But some is not enough.
It's not how we treat each other, okay?
Because the boys watching today will be the men of tomorrow.
I would love to get inside the heads of the executives who came up with that idea. What's their motivation? What's their motivation? Is it to, you know, shift their brand in the market so that we're a more caring, more touchy-feely brand, more attractive to a younger generation? Is that it? Or is it simply that they want to get the message out? That is this the best that men can be? Some people are calling it feminist propaganda. And somebody said that getting a woman to direct something like that is equivalent to getting a middle-aged man to make an ad about menstruation or something like that. So it's dividing people. It's very much dividing people. What isn't dividing people on Twitter today is there's people, somebody, and it's a lovely notion for the middle of January when we're all a bit down. Somebody's encouraging all Twitter users to share their first concert memories. The first, it's a rites of passage, isn't it? The first concert you go to. I was trying to remember, I think it was the House Martins in the SFX Hall there on the north side of Dublin, the St. Francis Xavier Hall. Yeah, Paul Heaton on lead vocals and your man was there, wasn't he? Fatboy Slim was in the band. I can't remember the other lads. And that was a bit of a mad one. Happy Hour, just a bit of it there from the House Martins. Because it is, you get to a certain age, don't you? And you're allowed to go up to Dublin if you don't live in Dublin. And you're on your own. And it's one of those moments, a rites of passage, first concert. I'm nearly sure it was that. I'm sure there were lesser ones around the Kildare area. But I think the first time I went to a concert in Dublin was the House Martins. I can't remember when that was. Anniversaries today. Today, back 20 years ago, is it? 20 years ago? Is it more than, must be... 20 years ago, Padraig Flynn, EU Commissioner, was on The Late Late Show. And it's one of those moments that people cite when they're going back on the history of The Late Late Show, when somebody got on and they thought they were going to be saying one thing. And in the end, they said something, well, not completely different, but they exposed a side of themselves, which they didn't intend to do. And the reason I know all about this is Will, who produced the show, Will Hanifin, was the researcher who worked on Padraig Flynn on The Late Late Show back 20 years ago on this day. And as a result of his appearance on The Late Late Show, Tom Gilmartin saw him because they used to show The Late Late Show on Tara Television in the UK. Tom Gilmartin was living in Luton. He saw it that night or maybe on the Monday, and he decided to give evidence to the Flood Tribunal. He had said he wasn't going to, but on seeing Padraig Flynn on The Late Late Show, he decided to change his mind. That was one thing that happened. The other thing that happened, I remember watching this. Journalist Barry O'Halloran was in the audience, and he asked EU Commissioner Padraig Flynn about his pay and expenses. And he said he's very well paid, and he calculated that he earned about £100,000 at the time net. And this is the clip from The Late Late Show 20 years ago today.
MEPs make an annual salary of, I think, 35 grand. Plus, they can make anything up to 200 grand a year in expenses. Is it the same for commissioners?
Well, I don't know how much exactly they get. But you're quite right that they do get the same salary, the starting salary, as a TD would get here at home, right? Then they get expenses from going... they get expenses from going over and back. I don't know exactly what it is. And as far as I am concerned, I get, give or take, it works out at about, with expenses, 140,000 a year, and I pay 30.3% tax on that. So it's about a net 100,000. And out of that 100,000, I run a home in Dublin, Castlebar and Brussels. I want to tell you something. Try it sometime when you have a couple of cars and three houses and three homes and a few housekeepers, and I want to tell you and everything else. But remember, it's a well-paid job. It's a well-paid job.
Sorry, I laugh. I know, I laugh. The way he spoke, that's condescension personified there. That was Padraig Flynn from The Late Late Show 20 years ago today. A year ago today, we lost one of our greatest musical talents, Dolores Reardon. And Dolores, of course, lead singer Dolores Reardon with the Cranberries. And so a lot of people are remembering her today. And I asked upstairs, what song would you like to hear? Zombie, Dreams, Linger. And every person in the room said, Ah, Linger. Ah, Linger. We'll have to play Linger. 51551, ray@rte.ie. Just on that Gillette ad, that ad is the feminization of men. Let them be masculine, says Anna. And they need to stop advertisers trying to make men into women. I'm a woman. There you go. And there's more on that, and we'll get to that after this. Linger, the Cranberries. In memory of the late Dolores Reardon there. What a lovely song. 51551 ray@rte.ie. On the wellness thing, live bacteria, eek, says that person. But isn't that the growing area of medicine now is the microbiome? And that's all the bacteria we have, a lot of it good bacteria in the gut. And we've spoken to a number of people over the last 4 years about it. Fecal transplants and varying your bacteria in the gut and all that sort of thing, and how it affects your health and your mental health. And it's the big growing area. There'll be a lot more about that, and we'll all be ingesting live bacteria in years to come. The stress of all those wellness regimes would make you sick, says that person. And I was watching a program on Channel 4 last night called How to Lose Weight Well. A doctor and nutritionist recommend diet plans, both crash and long-term ones, to candidates. Two diets recommend were a charcoal. Oh, there you go. Charcoal's obviously in. And a fast food diet. Both parties lost just under a stone within 2 weeks. Go figure, says Padraig. And please specify that you are talking about reversing type 2 diabetes. There's a difference between type 1 and type 2. And yes, sorry for that. And I should have made that quite clear. And I was going to say, I think people know that by now, but I don't think they do. So there are two types of diabetes. Obviously, type 1, which is autoimmune and can't be reversed or fixed, not caused by lifestyle. And then there is type 2 diabetes, which Dr. Ava Orsmond claimed on Saturday night is caused by lifestyle. On Gillette, oh my God, Ray, what a load of bull from Gillette. Save us from this rubbish that Gillette and me are finished for once, says Mike. So Mike's not buying any more Gillette products. Men are nicer today than they ever were, says Mary. And on concerts, my first concert was Shaken Stevens back in 1981 in the Boxing Arena in Dublin. That's the National Stadium. Unbelievably, I was 13 and went with my friends, the Sinead and Kildare. First concert, Elton John in the National Stadium in March 1979, just months before my leaving, says Kate. And my first concert was Bay City Rollers in the Crumlin Cinema circa 1974, maybe, says that person. And thanks for the Cranberries. They were my first concert, Pure Magic, so Sandra and Cork. Did I ever see them live? I don't think I did. And there's one on parental loneliness. We'll talk about that when we get to Jen, and one on swimming, and we'll talk about that when we get to Blondet. 51551 RadioRTE.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Our 51551 for your texts. Now it is January, and it is a time when we reconsider our health and our lifestyle habits. And a lot of us out there will be considering going on a diet. Well, Michael Mosley is the man who created the 5-2 diet, and his new book is The Fast 800, How to Combine Rapid Weight Loss and Intermittent Fasting for Long-Term Health. And Dr. Michael Mosley joins us on the line. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon. I hope the signal's okay. I'm on a mobile phone.
Okay.
The back of a car.
Okay.
It's not perfect.
But don't move. It sounds okay now.
Yes.
Okay.
Great.
Right. Well, thanks for taking time out. You're a very busy man. First, let's go back to the 5-2 diet and put it in context, because a lot of people poo-pooed the 5-2 diet when you wrote about it first. How many years ago was that?
That was 7 years ago. And you're right, people were sceptical, including the NHS, who described it as a fad diet. But they're now much more enthusiastic. And indeed, in their latest report, they concluded it could be better than a standard diet if you want to lose weight, and also if you want to improve things like your insulin levels.
Yes. And I suppose the thing about you and your books and your work is that it's all based on science.
Absolutely. So the other great thing that happened as a result of the fast diet, 5-2 diet coming out, is a lot of scientists started to do experiments. And the result is that there's a whole body of research now which didn't exist when I wrote the original book. I'm showing how beneficial intermittent fasting, and particularly the 5-2, is. And there was a big study out of Australia, for example, recently, which showed that at the end of a year, average weight loss sustained was 7 kilos. And for the top third, average weight loss was 13 kilos sustained for a year. It was pretty good going.
Michael, we're just going to take a break. We're going to try and get a better line, or maybe ring you back, because you're talking about things that are quite detailed. We need a sort of a better line. So we'll just try that. We'll take a commercial break and we'll talk to you after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
That's sad. Now, we can't get a good enough line, a good enough connection with Dr. Michael Mosley there, so we leave it for the moment. His book is The Fast 800. And I'd read it and all, and I'd done all my homework, and I was ready for him. And we'll get him back at a later date. Now, being a first-time parent can be a really lonely experience. Jen Hogan has been writing about this, and she joins us in studio. Good afternoon, Jen.
How
good to see you again.
And you?
Move in there.
Oh, yes.
It's a bit closer. How long is this into you were a first-time parent?
17 and a half years.
Right.
Going back a bit, all right.
So what triggered you thinking about this again, thinking about how lonely you were?
I think it was because, I mean, I'd have parents write to me an awful lot. I'd have mothers in particular write to me a lot, constantly talking about how lonely they find parenthood. And about a year ago, I came out of the office environment and I'm working from home mostly now. And it was a big worry for me coming out of work, thinking, what am I going to do? I won't have colleagues. I won't have friends around. I'm going to be in the house on my own. And as someone who kind of doesn't really like being on her own very much, I'm a people person. I'm much happier in company. I had the same kind of the fear. And I realised that I actually nearly had to do the same things again. Even 7 children on, I had to do the same things again to try to avoid loneliness this time. Yeah. Because it is very easy to kind of fall into bad habits when you're tied and you're restricted. And parenthood, even though I said I've done it 7 times now, the challenges change, but so the need kind of to make a concerted effort to avoid loneliness remains.
Well, bring us back to then your first child then 17 and a half years ago. Yeah. So what were the circumstances?
So we had a kind of really crazy year. I was only young, and between the ages of 23 and 24, we had bought our first car, bought our first house, just got married, and then a couple of weeks later found out we were expecting our first baby. So it's just constant excitement. It was fantastic. I couldn't wait. I knew always that I was hoping to have a large family, and I was so
thrilled. Why so?
I don't know. That was the funny thing. I come from a house of 4 children, which is pretty standard from my own generation. But I just knew I always wanted, if I was lucky enough, to have a load of children. And that was kind of crazy when you think I had never even held a baby, save my little sister, until I held Chloe. And the first night she was born, I remember calling the midwife going, she's done a poo. And she's looking at me. Because I just figured, there was kind of going to be a settling in period. Obviously there wasn't. And I was looking forward to Chloe being born, looking forward to having my, as she was a little girl, I didn't realise the time. But I was always also a little bit nervous about leaving work because I enjoyed the buzz of work. I enjoyed kind of the company. I enjoyed being busy all the time. And we had moved to a house in a different location. So we bought a house in Kildare. Neither of us are from Kildare. We had no family around. Now, he's from Carlow, so it wasn't too far away. And I'm from Dublin. So we were kind of in the middle. But at the same time, there were no friends and family around. None of my friends were even considering having babies.
You're
you know?
24, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, because, well, it was typical for my own mum's generation to have children at that age. It isn't anymore. And it
this was in the year 2000.
2001, Chloe was born,
yes,
yeah.
Right,
so
okay.
It was just, I suppose, it was only when she came along and I really started to realise what was involved in parenthood and that it wasn't actually so easy to get out and that all of a sudden, I living in the area that I lived in, I never really thought the fact that I didn't know anyone around there because I was gone to work every day. It was a commute, you know, it was quite a commute to work every day. So I was gone early in the morning, back late in the evening. And when I was on my own with a small baby every day and kind of not very confident. So if you have a little one who's kind of unsettled, which my daughter was at the time, she was kind of colicky and I was a little bit worried about going out because I thought, oh, if I take her out, she's going to start crying. People will be looking at me. That's assuming I could actually get myself together to get out the door.
And of course, then that you're a bad mother if your baby's crying.
You can't handle your own child. Come on, you've got one baby. Yeah. Like, how hard can it be?
Do you remember the day that your husband went back to work?
I do.
Because a lot of women talk about that day.
I do. I remember the night before. I remember Chloe woke up and I was sobbing because she woke up and I was sobbing because I was trying to change her baby grow. And I still remember I caught her little toe in the baby grow and she kind of let out a squelch and that was it. Like a total emotional breakdown. And it was a combination of the poor little one having her getting upset because I'd heard her changing her baby girl and knowing I am going to be on my own with this little girl day in, day out, every day. And I have no one to call to come to visit. Everybody was so busy. There's not going to be anyone around and I'm going to have to get on with this. And knowing because, again, we had a commute, it was going to be kind of late by the time Paul got home every evening. I was going to have to work it out on my own. So
a long day.
It was a really long day. And
and people don't talk about that because some of it can be quite boring.
It is. And you see, you're not supposed to say that because you're supposed to be absolutely thrilled to have this gorgeous new baby. And I was. But like, it's monotonous. It's boring. And little one doesn't talk back to you, you know. And it's this kind of, I suppose, this total contradiction of feelings. You're absolutely over the moon to have this beautiful, new, healthy baby. But you just wish there was some parts of your old life still there as well, you know, that your colleagues, friends around just to chat about adult things too.
So did you feel isolated?
I did, very isolated. I suppose there were some days I'd have noticed went by that I didn't see anybody until Paul came in the evening time. Or if I got out, I saw strangers, but nobody that I was having proper conversations with, just kind of passing niceties, I suppose, really.
Yeah.
And it was that feeling, dreading every weekend coming to an end, knowing he was going back. And I was weighing quite heavily on Paul too. I was expecting him to provide all the adult company and stimulation that I needed, which is unfair.
And of course, you were lucky in that you didn't suffer from postnatal depression.
Oh, I did.
I did.
And I suppose that it really added to it. So it was a really difficult situation because when you've got postnatal depression and you're feeling so low, I mean, you say terrible things to yourself when you're feeling low. You're not as kind to yourself as you should be. And I had they were really complimenting each other dreadfully, really. You know,
isolation and go on.
So I suppose it was a period I look back in my life that I wish I'd known then. Like we all say that your hindsight's great, you know. I wish I'd known then
what
I know now. And I know now, seven children on, that sometimes you just kind of got to grab the bull by the horns and get out there and try and help yourself overcome it. That would be, definitely my advice.
So how do you do that, though? Because and you say, and particularly a first child, and I know it can happen at any stage in parenting, but all of those insecurities and lack of confidence and, you know, doing things for the first time, all of those are knocking you down, you back.
They are.
And then to say, get out there and meet new people.
Like you don't feel so great about yourself. You go, oh, out you go now. Go on and charm everybody. Everyone, be my friend. But there is that kind of feeling. But I suppose I used what was starting to become really popular then and is even more so now. I used the internet a little bit to start making friends. I mean, it wasn't my only way, but it was one of the things that I did. Was I went onto a lot of parenting forums and I noticed that people using their kind of their ideas, so they're not their real names. People were a lot more honest because I know people might argue that you can hide behind a username and pretend to be
they're
somebody
anonymous.
Different.
Yeah,
I suppose a trust kind of built up in particular mums-to-be groups and new mum groups. And I got chatting to other women online about different experiences. Some of them were on first time babies, some of them had other children, but I suppose we were all in the same situation. There was nobody around, you know. There was, it doesn't seem to be just unique to first time motherhood.
And I'd say that's still the case in some sort of on the commuter belt.
Yes.
In the States, where everybody gets up in the morning and
they're
goes
gone
to Dublin.
So yes, early. Yes. I suppose that's just it. They're gone so early and they're back so late. And I suppose that's what's changed so much. There isn't this collaborative approach to parenthood anymore. There isn't, because people are so busy. You don't know your neighbours. You're not necessarily close to your friends and family, even with it. It's so expensive to buy property.
Geographically.
You're you're so far away from people. You don't have the support network that you had before. Plus, we're all having babies at different stages of life. You know, when my own mum was having had me, I think she was 21 going on 22, and it was fairly typical of her generation, and all the mothers on the road, they were all having babies at the same time, they were all at home.
And she was probably living close to her mother, your granny,
well,
was she? No,
she had moved out at that stage, so she'd moved out a bit of a distance. But all the women, I remember waking up one day and my next door neighbour's little child was in the bed beside me because my next door neighbour had gone into labour during the night. There was that kind of supportive approach.
Back to you then, how did you know, counteract that isolation?
Well, as well as I suppose
going online,
I remember at the time when I was living in Newbridge, a neighbour had, I suppose, the joys of it. It was a new estate, and my neighbour had a party, a housewarming party, and she invited loads of the people on the road to it. And Chloe was quite young, and I remember Paul going, "Come on, like you like socialising, let's go, we'll go along." So reluctantly, I went along, and I met another neighbour there, and we had never spoken to each other. We'd been living there months, and we'd wait. You know, as the cars went by, and actually she'll know who she is. We used to call them Posh and Becks because she had a particular haircut and she looked like Victoria Beckham. And I remember chatting to her, and when I was speaking to her, my friend told me, you know, she'd had some fertility difficulties, and she's my friend now. I didn't know her at the time, and these are the sort of things that we didn't know about our neighbours because I didn't even know what her name was until then. She was Posh. And we kind of struck up a friendship. So even though we weren't at the same stage of parenthood, she wasn't even yet pregnant, we were, I suppose, two new people in the same area, because I think that's one of the real challenges of loneliness in parenthood. You don't necessarily, you know, making friends with other mothers, you need a tribe, but you need somebody with whom you've more in common with than just having a child. Yeah, So this girl, Diane, actually, her name is, and we ended up being great friends, and she did eventually become pregnant, and she was a great support, and we were a great support to each other. She was living quite a distance away from home. She used to, it was funny, when I went back to work, she was then on maternity leave, and I remember she used to say, I'd get a call and work on, I can't hack much more of this, I'm so bored, when will you be home? And I'd come home and she'd have something, like she had my lunch ready, and it looked really funny now, here you'd walk it in like I was as if I was spoiled rotten, your woman with my lunch ready, so that we could get out in the afternoon, because it was that desperation, and I understood where she was coming from. I'd felt that kind of loneliness in the morning. I'd come back, and that helped, because we were two women, I suppose, at similar stages of life, both removed from not living close to our family, not having our friends around, our core group of friends weren't around us, and we were a great support to each other. But she did eventually move, and I moved. And by the time second time motherhood came around again, there was the same challenges when I had my second baby. I was living in a different area again. So it became, I needed to find another way to overcome kind of loneliness again. Again, I didn't know my new neighbours. It was, again, an area that I wasn't from. And this time I turned to the public health nurse, and I suppose she was brilliant. And I remember saying to her, look, I had postnatal depression the first time around and I really struggled with loneliness and I'm terrified of it happening again. I have now a toddler and a baby. It's going to be even harder to get out. And I remember her saying to me, okay, look, let me think about it. Would you be okay if I chatted to other young mums in the area who I'm sure are going to be feeling the same as you? You know, this is so much more common than you think. Just people don't talk about it, but it really is something that an awful lot of parents feel. And she did. She put me in common. And there are some people that obviously all you do have in common with is that you're a mum. Like you're different, but you have different interests, you're different. But there was other women that I met that we became great friends. So between that and attending the breastfeeding support groups and the mother and child, all the typical things that's advised of you, there's a combination of different things that I tried. But I also went back to doing things that I loved, that Jen herself, before being a mom, when I moved back to Dublin, I joined the Coast Guard and I was a volunteer with the Coast Guard for a while, which was totally different to being a mum. Like, it was just, and I think that's really what I needed. It was when I did that, I realised that I needed a friendship and to overcome kind of the loneliness that I was experiencing. I needed to claim back the bit of me that was, yes, was me, yeah, but also to have a tribe of mums that were still the same.
I think, is it enough to be identified as a mum? Do you think people need more than that?
It's a huge privilege to be a mum.
Yes.
But I am still Jen before I had 7 children. Yes. Like, I am still the same woman. I have many more commitments now, you know, and many more restrictions upon me. But at the same time, yeah, I need to be more than mum. I need to be, it is the thing I'm proudest of, but I need to be more than, because I am more than mum, you know, it's a huge part of who I am, but I'm still me too.
And how did you get over the postnatal depression? Did you seek
for
treatment?
I did. Yeah, I mean, the first time around, it's happened to me 6 now of the 7 times.
You had postnatal depression.
You think it'd be enough to put a woman off, wouldn't you? And even that, I've made a joke about it, but that was actually something I was terribly sensitive about, because I used to feel people might judge me and they go, well, why would you keep having children? Every time I did have to turn to medication, but I did resist it each time, and because I didn't want to accept that it was happening again. But it was actually medication, going to the doctor, and then becoming numb enough with the medication to do the things that I needed to do to get better, I suppose, which for me was get out there. And
I haven't had it 6 times, which is more than most people. What's your understanding of why it happens?
I'm trying to think what was different. The only time I didn't have was after the birth of my 2nd child. And the only thing I can think of, I would have to assume that it has to be to do with a drop in hormones. I mean, I know they say this anyway, but I would have to assume that's what happened to me, the sudden drop in hormones. But I know the isolation and the loneliness and the restrictions that were on me, the inability to get out as freely, those sort of things, they did play a part for me.
So it's an environmental.
It's environmental and hormonal. I think it's a combination of both. Yeah. And so that's why it needed kind of the double approach to overcome it. I needed to help correct.
So you went back to work eventually, and now you're working at home.
Now I'm working at home again.
And that triggered all these things.
So it triggered all these things of loneliness. I know that put everyone in a panic.
And I'm sure there are people listening to us now who work from home.
Yeah.
And that has its own challenges as well, doesn't it?
It does. Well, besides being very difficult to separate the two lives, you know, and to kind of have a foot against the door while you're on the phone to a radio station sometimes, which is my life. And that was one of the things when the article came out, I got a lot of contact from women who said that they related to this also even further down the road, even though they were parents for quite a while at this stage, when they moved to working from home, this huge isolation, you know, they're standing at the school gates, but they don't have time to maybe have kind of chat with the parents who are actually at home because they have to run back and get work done. And I suppose I find that, like, it's the best of both worlds, but it's a challenge as well because I'm at home. I don't have the colleagues around me that I miss because I had fabulous work colleagues. I miss them. But what I don't have either is necessarily the free time to meet up with some of the other mums who are at home because I have got to get back up deadlines or different things to do, so that I don't have that freedom. So it is a challenge. So I do have to make sure that I get out there on other occasions and set aside that time.
I think in life we have to make an effort.
You do, yeah. I think that's one of the things I get older.
If we sit at home, that you will become isolated.
You do. I think that's it. I was sitting there the first time around. I suppose I was waiting for some of these things to pass, and really it was that I suppose is one of the joys of having 7 children and all that experience. You learn that you actually have to get out there sometimes and help yourself, but it isn't always as easy if you're not feeling great and you're not confident or you're worried about all the other aspects, because it's not just about getting out there and putting yourself out there and trying to meet strangers. It's not as easy as for children who can just go up to strangers in the park and just go, hey, be my friend, or they're kind of likely to be reported.
That's
just it.
So 7, you've said that a number of times, 7 children. So the eldest is 17 and a half and the youngest is 3.
He's 3, yeah.
And that's it, I presume.
Should we never say never? My mother-in-law's listening, she should be having a heart attack altogether. That woman's off again. No, I mean, yeah, it's fairly... 7 is very full on.
And is it 6 boys and 1 girl?
6 boys and 1 girl. She's first, and then the 6 lads followed. So it's... we are.
And is it true? You can speak from experience that... Girls wreck your
head. I only said that to my neighbour yesterday.
Boys wreck the house.
Wreck the house. My boys wreck the house. That's what they do. But you know what is great in having having so many children and even having so many of the same gender? It really does dispels kind of any myths about, but you know, it was funny, I heard you talking about the Gillette ad there, the boys will be boys. Like, my lads are so different to each other. They may as well be different genders sometimes. Like, it's I love getting to see that. I actually hate to see, it's the same for anybody, I'm sure, with loads of girls and being a woman and having been a girl myself. I know all girls are not the same and all women are not the same, and nor is the same boys. You know, my lads are so different. I love to see how different they are, and it really annoys me to hear people say, oh, sure, boys will be boys, or that's what boys are like, or the kind of the expectations that there is, the societal expectations of boys. Life can be pretty tough for boys. There are some pretty...
No, I read an article yesterday about toxic masculinity, and there, you know, it's required of them nearly. Yeah. In some places, you know, and things are changing, which is great. Mm-hmm. But we still do have a problem with toxic masculinity.
Oh, absolutely.
And how boys think they need to behave.
Yes, that's it. I mean,
to fulfil the role of being a male.
A male. And they're even hearing this message from such a young age, you know, kind of toughen up, and, you know, you're going to have to get, you're going to have to get tougher. This is how boys are. This is what boys like. This is how boys behave. Yeah. So when I saw the Gillette ad this morning, I actually really liked it. I thought it was really good. So whatever their reason for doing it, I think it's great.
Okay, let's see what they're saying here. There's loads of them anyway. I'm in total awe of my mum, who raised four children close in age and took it in her stride while working as well, and as a single mother in the 70s, the problem for me was survival, says that person. I was left alone with my 6-week-old son when my husband had to go back to work at sea. This was just before Christmas 1985. We didn't see him again until March, as he worked 4 months on and 4 months off. You just have to be strong and get on with it. No mobile phones in the 1980s, just letters. I was lucky that his family lived close by, but you still had to get on with it. And of course, back in the day, I'm just thinking about my childhood, like, my granny lived across the green from us, and she was a constant support to my mum, you know, with 9 children. Where are you going to talk to that lady about loneliness of being a first-time mother? I just want to say it can happen anytime. After I had my second child, I thought, my God, it was a completely different experience. There weren't as many visitors. People assume because you've had one baby,
you know what you're doing,
you're some sort of pro.
Mm-hmm,
It took a lot longer for me to bond with baby number two. At times I thought it wouldn't happen. But thankfully, after about 6 weeks, things just clicked. Every child is different. Every experience is different. It's nothing to be ashamed of. Talking really, really helped. And I'm expecting my first baby in April, and I was only thinking about this. Could you ask Jen, is there anything she would do anything differently?
Anything differently? Well, do you know what I would do? I would let more people know how I was feeling. I think I was a little bit embarrassed to admit how lonely I was, you know, because lots of people were admiring this beautiful baby that I had. And when people say to you, how do you do it? Or are in awe of you in any way for being so lucky to have this lovely baby or manage with anything that you do, you don't want to let them down and say, actually, you know what? It's really lonely and I really envy you actually getting to get out of the house sometimes, or just let people know that you actually would appreciate visitors, because that is the other side. Sometimes people don't come to visit because they're afraid, you know, that you're too busy or they don't want to be treading on toes, and there's a whole balance that has to be struck there. So definitely let people know what you want. There's also, I've heard loads of people say that they don't want any visitors those first couple of weeks. They just want it to be them and maybe baby daddy and bonding with the child. There's so many different ideals about those early weeks, so I think it's best to let people know what you'd like.
What you want. When I moved from Dublin to me, I ended up setting up a parent and toddler group so my son and I could meet others from the area. To my surprise, so many parents showed up to the first meeting that I had to set up a second group. Such was the need, says Aoife. And when I had a baby, some friends stayed away from me because they felt I was overwhelmed by it all. I was overwhelmed, but company is always good. Yeah. And I heard on the radio when I had my first baby, young mothers need mothering. How true.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you need.
Yeah, you see there, yeah.
We have this whole thing, you know, oh, well, it's totally natural, you know, and it's, you know, everybody's done it before and the previous generation done it before, but society has changed so much, and women and men, of course, parents are parenting in very different circumstances now, and without that kind of, that whole village that it takes to rear a child, it is hard. It's really hard. Actually, the one on the parent or the baby and toddler group is a great idea. That's something I remember that I did too, and that I would often say to mums who are that little bit less confident about going out and going to these things. You kind of host the morning yourself. Maybe mums that you know from Montessori drops, particularly if it's not the first time. In your own house, you know. And it doesn't need to be any great trouble. Go down to your local supermarket. There's not, no one, well, it certainly wouldn't want to be testing my domesticity skills because I know that's not my strength at all. But, you know, go down and get some cakes and coffees or whatever you're comfortable with and have a few women over. That can be a big help, and you can feel sometimes a bit more comfortable if it's in your own home too.
Postnatal depression is definitely a chemical and hormonal imbalance together with constraints of having a very dependent new baby. This happened to me, isolation, self-imposed pressure to feel and act normal with lack of sleep and a break in our normal daily routine just brings so many changes all at the same time. It's overwhelming.
It is. It's absolutely overwhelming. I think nothing can quite prepare you for the first time. And even though you do know, as the lady pointed out there, even though you might know what's coming the second time around, sometimes that can nearly be as hard because people don't come knocking and they think, sure, she knows what she's doing. It'll be all grand.
Last one then. I found when I had my two new babies, it was the loneliest time in my life. In hindsight, I wish that the public health nurse could have put me and all the other new mothers in the area in touch with each other.
That's what the public health nurse did with me the second time around, and it made a huge difference. And she chose women in the nearly in my immediate locality, which was great because it meant it was so much easier to get
and
out.
And you asked her?
I asked her.
See, there you go. Yeah.
But I suppose that's the joy
you
of
made
the second
the
thing.
On that,
I suppose there's difference. In fairness, I don't think I'd have been brave enough to do it the first time around. Or I don't think I'd have even thought of it the first time around. I suppose it was my second time around and I was desperate not to repeat.
Hopefully our little chat has helped.
I hope
people.
So, yeah.
Thanks so much for coming
Thanks a million, Ray. Great
Hogan.
To be in.
5155 on RayRT.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or 51551 for your text, Ray at RTE. Loads of texts coming in about the first concert. I'm very envious of some of these people. Madness in the Olympic Ballroom, 1980. I was 15. To this day, one of the best gigs I was ever at. Even the support was great. The Go-Go's. I remember we got the beat. My first summer job in London, went to see Carole King Tapestry in Hammersmith Odeon in 1973. We'll never forget the sound as the curtain rose. Neil in Cork says, first concert, Beach Boys in the Adelphi, 1966. Concert tickets were £6, 2 weeks' wages at the time. Great memories. And my first concert I went to was in the early 60s, I think, in the Boxing Stadium to see Chubby Checker. He did the twist and the stadium erupted with girls screaming. I was with my older sister and we didn't know what was going on, but we loved doing the twist. Good memories. That's Alison there. And my first concert was Aha in the RDS, 1984. We got backstage passes. Look at you. In the van on the way there, the back axle and back wheels fell off the van. Some cracks as Debbie. The memories are made of this. And my first concert was Leonard Cohen in the National Stadium. My ex-husband and I were living in Kerry. We hitched to Dublin, got a lift the whole way. And we leave one more before we leave that. And my first concert was Slane, 1981. Thin Lizzy topped the bill, followed by Hazel O'Connor. Remember D-Day's Hazel O'Connor? And of course, Will You, with the best sax solo of any song ever. U2 were on it as well. Rose Tattoo, Sweet Savage and Smiley Bulger. Hazel O'Connor was stunning. A great day out, says Liam. Their first concert memories. Now, yesterday we spoke to Dara McGee. And Dara is from the University of Bath and he's done research on gambling and sport. And particularly we spoke about what has happened and the changes that have happened in football, soccer, over the last 10, 15 years. 7 of the 20 teams in the Premier League, the Premiership, are sponsored by betting companies. And I think it's in the double figures in the first division or whatever it's called now. And also on top of that, you have all the billboards around the pitches. And then you have the constant ads at half time encouraging you to bet more on who's going to get the next corner, who's going to scratch their nose, who's going to pick out a bit of nasal hair or whatever. That's how daft it's become. Anyway, we got an email, a number of emails. I'll just bring you one. I think we've won a chance for one before we go to Nocht. Hey Ray, I'm emailing you after listening to your guest yesterday, Dara McGee, who did research about gambling in today's society. I suppose I should start with the fact that I am a recovering compulsive gambler and I'm recovering from gambling since 2000. Your guest yesterday highlighted the issue facing young men and women today around gambling and how easy it is for them to gamble on phones, coupled with how much advertisement and sponsorship there is in all sports around gambling. This is not new information for me, as I hear it in Gamblers Anonymous meetings and see it every day as I have a heightened awareness to avoid this type of advertising. But there's something Dara might have missed, which is that because the gambling scene has changed dramatically in the past 20 years, the type of compulsive gambler I see in meetings is a different person to help or to treat than men, women that were in the meetings 20 years ago. Right, you have me. You have me interested. To explain this, I can only compare myself to the new breed of compulsive gambler. And when I do, there is one standout difference. When I got caught up in gambling, it was to escape reality. It was nothing to do with winning or losing money. It was, for me, an escape from the pain I was suffering. I started to gamble at 12. This was also when I started boarding school, but gambling progressed at a rapid pace until I saw treatment in 2000, by which time it had nearly destroyed me, along with that which was really hurting me inside. In treatment and meetings until 2009, I got the best support I could have got, but until I was willing to talk about what my real issues were, I was still only what we call a dry drunk. All those years in recovery and still hurting, what a waste. I am either a slow learner, Ray, or just too thick-headed. But that's me. Anyway, this is the difference between me and people in GA rooms around the country back then compared to the new breed of compulsive gambler. We had issues that gambling gave us an escape from, but the majority of today's gamblers don't. Now, this is this person's theory, this person's opinion. They are compulsive gamblers because it's fun. When the fun stops, stop. What a load of S-H-I-T-E. If it's fun for them, it's much harder to stop than it was for me trying to escape from reality. And the fact is, most of the new people in meetings today keep going back. For me, I was hurting inside and in debt as well. The new person is only in debt. And if that debt can be sorted, they will most likely go back and do it all over again and again. Gambling, Ray, is the most insidious and dangerous of addictions. You may well ask why. Because you, or any of your listeners, can spot an alcoholic or a drug addict on the streets of your towns and cities, but you won't spot a compulsive gambler. But back a few years ago, I could spot a compulsive gambler on the streets a mile off, because I am one. I could see the pain etched all over their face, but today I can't see them. And today I can't even see the pain on their faces when they come to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting. Please don't get me wrong. Today's compulsive gambler is the same as me in every way. I was at the beginning of treatment. We have the same habits, traits and actions. Gambling teaches you those traits. The new compulsive gambler will get the same recovery treatment as I did, and if they apply it, the treatment will work. But nowadays, it seems only for a short period until they wish to go back and have more fun. Because today, the big gambling companies have a better hook into the compulsive gambler. Their advertising is completely different to 20 years ago, which there was little or none, and their shops on the high street are totally different compared to back then, when mostly there was a small dark place at the end of the street that you looked up and down the street before entering to check if someone saw you entering and went inside. And when you went inside, it was a dirty and seedy place to be. The gambling companies have cleaned their act up, made it easy and fun to have a bet, so you don't even have to be in a betting shop now to place a bet. So ask yourself, why wouldn't a compulsive gambler go back for more, as long as he can afford it? It's fun, according to the bookies. Gambling destroys lives, and it will continue to do so regardless as if advertised as fun or not. We need regulation on gambling in this country badly, as bad as we need investment into cancer research, because gambling is a cancer, says that person. So there you go. And we've got others as well, which we might bring to you throughout the week. But Anish, Tosha Naum de Fiv Skelton and Nocta Lamora de Wallish. Thanks, Greg. Thanks very much. Gurmahagat Mora de Wallish. 51551ray@rte.ie. Just on that Gillette ad, and you can go up if you put it into Google there, you'll see it. It's a 2-minute ad. And they're trying to, I suppose, reposition themselves and reposition men. I think the Gillette ad is great. I'm a man with a 2-year-old boy who I will bring up to respect everybody, not just women. Men need to accept that we're all not perfect and need to change our attitudes. Equally, women need to accept that they're not all perfect either. So that's that. Have you seen it, Blondie Coffee? You've seen the Gillette ad?
No. I used to try and use my father's razor back in the day when I started.
Too much information.
I'm just being honest with you. But I didn't realise that you probably shouldn't share blades. So I'm trying to teach that with the teenage lads at home.
Right.
And yes, it's an ongoing issue. The cost of them.
Now, the reason you're in here is because you're learning to swim. Can I ask you what age you are?
Of course you can. Yeah. I never had a TV age like some of our colleagues, Raymond. I'm honest about my age. I never lied about it. And I think I'm very proud of it. I am 48.
Okay. Have you never learned to swim before?
I was going to lie. Well, it was going to be a white. I did. It didn't work. I did one-to-one. I actually paid a ridiculous amount of money, a long time ago and it didn't work. Right. So I don't know why. I'd love to tell you I've had a very traumatic experience. I haven't. I didn't nearly drown, nothing like that. My mother sent all her first four children, we all went to lessons in trim together, and I can remember going down to the lessons. I do not know why my siblings can swim and I can't.
Right.
I can't.
And you, do you have a fear?
I don't want to put my face in the water.
Right.
Which doesn't make sense, really.
That's going to stop you swimming.
I know, but I dipped it last night at my second lesson. And Now I had the, of course, I had this time I brought goggles, which would have made sense last week at the original class, the first class. But you see, of course, you're roaring, has anyone got goggles? And someone throws a pair of goggles at you in our house, but there's a big knot on them. And then they broke and then nothing went my way. And I was 25 minutes into the class and I just wanted to cry. Because nothing was working.
Okay, before we get to the classes, why now?
Well, you see, when they were small, they are those other four
children.
Yes, but they're not children anymore. They're going to live in my house forever and ever and ever, and I know that. When they were small, and because my husband Kieran is such a good swimmer, he always had a thing, they have to swim. I mean, Sheila was a week old. She wasn't even christened, to my mother's disgrace, and she was down the pool, you know? So they could always swim. I had a point, you know, I made a point, they have to be able to swim. And they could, I could throw them off the pier in Dunleary and they could swim. They're all brilliant swimmers. And then when they could swim, I thought, great, they can swim. And then last year we were away and only the younger two, the older two wouldn't dare holiday with us now. They said, Kieran said to me, I said, well, at least I don't have to worry about them not being able to swim. It's great, you know, because they were going out a bit. And he goes, yeah, but what if you're out there and you have difficulty and they go and try and save you and they drown saving you? Because what you do if you have a fear of putting your head going under is you panic.
Yeah.
And I thought he was being really mean. I didn't speak to him for the rest of the day. I thought it was really mean, but it was honest. If I panicked.
Very honest, because.
And it did, I didn't
that
like
that. Happens an awful lot where in people attempting to save somebody else, in your panic, the person who's drowning, they bring them down and both people die. And it's
but
terrible.
You hear it every summer. Do you know when you hear of two young lads or two young people go swimming? I don't want to think about it now. It's awful. And then I had such guilt and I said, God. And then I'll be 50 in 2 years. And I thought, I'll learn to swim before I'm 50. I have to now. And I kind of didn't tell anyone. I looked up what time the classes were on. It's only across the road from me. I have no excuse. But last week when I had to go, I didn't want to go. I was sitting by the fire and it was lovely and it was cosy. And, you know, I was just kind of going, everyone's had dinner and it'd be nice just to chill. And then my 16-year-old, who can be, what's the word? Cheeky, but I'm cheeky myself. He says, you won't go anyway. And it just annoyed me. And I thought, by God, I'm going.
He was putting it up to you.
He was. And you know, it's nothing like a teenager daring you, because I just won't show anyone I won't or can't do something, you know. But he put it up to me and I went, I was disastrous.
Is it one-on-one again? Or
no, and I think this is better because, you know me, I'm a people person and there's loads of women. It's mostly women. And they're a bit of crack, you know. Like there's an old woman who's been doing lessons for years and she says, I don't know why it doesn't work. I just think she goes for the crack. And then there's another woman who said, I'm so embarrassed because like my kids are learning to swim and I can't swim. And I went, oh my God, been there, you know. But if you let it go, you let it go for too long. So she's going. But she said something really funny to me last night. She's taken up for the new year, swimming in gin. So now ask me what the connection is. I think she's going to give herself a lovely glass of gin after 5 weeks. But no, I don't know. It's a real mix. And there's a woman from Brazil. And I don't know why I thought that was a big deal that she couldn't swim. Then I thought, we live on an island. Why can't I swim?
Yeah. It says 1 in 5 Irish adults can't swim. I reckon the numbers are more than that.
Oh, I think it's... Yeah. Oh, I think it's more.
And it gets to a stage where you're not willing to admit it because it is embarrassing.
Oh, it's very embarrassing.
Yeah.
Like when I did the video and I did one Oscail again, one in English, right? And I did Oscail because of my own programme on Saturday mornings on Radio Gaelta. So I said, I'll put this up. And next thing, this fella who comes on our show regularly to do sports for us on Saturday morning, he's 30, he's fit, he used to work for the GAA, he's all about sport. And he said live on air last Saturday, "Bon, it's fair play, like, because I can't swim either." Yeah. And he took the biggest Redner. And I thought, wow. It is embarrassing though, Ray, because everyone, like, it's like reading, writing. You know, one of the things you do when you're rearing kids is learn to swim.
It's a basic life skill. No, I didn't learn until I was 39.
Yeah, but you're all about the sea. You're at another level. Like, you can jump into the sea.
I can't still jump into the sea.
Yeah, but you can swim in the sea.
I can swim in the sea, yeah. But no, I don't go to my depth. I'm still a coward.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know, just on the sitting in front of the fire of an evening, just this might help you out. This is, somebody explained this to me, a psychologist or a psychiatrist or some scientist, that we've a reserve of willpower. right? So if you can imagine in the morning, we have a full bottle of willpower,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you want to do something in the morning, it's easy because you have loads of willpower.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But as the day goes on, you eat into your reserve of willpower. So by the time you get to 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, you have very little willpower.
Yeah, but life drains it from you too.
Well,
and
you
everything
know, energy
is everyone's
yeah.
pulling out of you.
Yeah, yeah.
Like everyone wants a bit of you. You know, and you know, you think nothing of that. But as you get older, you realise there isn't that much of yourself you're actually holding for yourself.
Mm. Apart from being embarrassed by your children and your husband, well, he guilted you big time.
Yeah, and he didn't even say sorry since. That's worse.
Don't have your domestics on air, please.
Oh, well, I'll have it when I go home. It's just reminding me to add it to my to-do list to give out about.
On your own time, please. What do you want to achieve? How will it change your life?
Well, it's funny. I had a little panic attack last year. And I think I have a habit of holding a lot of tension right in my chest, right? A lot of women apparently do this. And I do the shallow breathing when I get a bit up in a heap, right? And my shoulders go up, okay? And yoga is brilliant for me, right? And I noticed that, weirdly, if I could exercise my shoulders and control my breathing, it would help me in general, I think. And I feel quite strong about that in the sense that of the research I've done, like, you know, just as me looking up stuff. But I kind of also would like to do something, I know this is for me, you know, that doesn't involve, you know, doesn't involve sort of having to get into a group of people to do, you know, my yoga class is lovely and it's small and I would die if I didn't do it on Monday mornings, and no one can mess with that 9:15 Monday. It's my thing and yeah. I don't care what anyone says. I get lost in it and it's great and I love it. But I just would like something that had a little bit more movement of my body, but it was just me.
And what do you think you've missed out over the years on holidays?
I know it's really weird and I'm so spoiled. I have a big man as a husband, as you know. And my husband, you know, he floats me in the sea. I know that's really, he holds me up, he brings me out to a rock.
Right.
You know, we have a lovely, lovely sort of intimate world in the water. It sounds very strange, but we have this relationship, but he's my backup and he's my guide in the water. And I think he's facilitated that.
Did you say he was a lifeguard?
Yeah, he used to be like years ago, he was a lifeguard and he's a good swimmer. But I love the way he minds me and holds me in the water and all that. And he's enabled my issues. More of that when I go home. But like, and then I suppose I would stand so proud when I'd see the kids take off and out of their depth and their stroke. And I'd be boasting about it. Like, and when they're in Sea Scouts, it was the best thing ever. Like they could do anything like that. And even when they used to jump off the pier as a task when the Sea Scouts, my heart would be in my mouth, but I'd be so proud. So I love everything.
To the point of tears nearly.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's nothing like, and I remember Sheila took off once and took a boat for someone down to Kerry and then up to Galway. Meet her in Galway and her coming up wrecked looking. Yeah. I thought, oh my God, look what she did. She's a natural. Queen Maeve of the seas, you know. But yeah, I mean, I love all that about them, but you can't live in their heads.
How did you fail on previous occasions? Like, how far did you get and did you just give up or?
Yeah, I never got the head down. You know the dip, I know we're on radio, you know the hands are up.
Yeah, the hands are outstretched.
Outstretched, sorry.
And then
okay.
your head goes into the water between your hands. Yeah,
so I take off, right, and the feet are really good, I'm really good. I'd say I was a penguin in a previous life. I can do the flippy feet thing, right? And I'm down there and then one, two...
Strokes, front crawl.
Three, the third arm to the side and breathe. But you see, now look at me.
Yeah.
I was going to the side to breathe. I was going...
Yeah.
I wasn't taking a breath because I was panicking. Yeah. And then in the last 15, 20 minutes of the class last night, voila, bubbles. Blowing the bubbles.
Yeah, blowing the bubbles underwater.
He was telling me to blow them, but sure, I'm not going to blow a bubble. The next thing, I'll take loads of water in my nose on the inhale. But last night, I controlled my breathing. There was none of this panic breathing. And then I said, wow, I think I could do it now. So I'm going to give myself another go outside of the lesson by the end of the week.
See, as an adult, there's an advantage in that you can take instruction. So that when your instructor tells you to blow bubbles underwater, blah, 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 blah. But they give you 15 instructions. And at the end, what do they say to you? And relax.
I know. And then the other thing they say to you, you have to practice. Yeah, but it's exhausting. I was out of breath. I was wrecked last night. I had pains everywhere last week. Yeah. I had pain in here, like right under your armpit.
Is that your rotator cuff or something?
Oh, whatever
like that.
It is. It's killing me. Yeah. And you see, and you know, you make every excuse. Oh, my togs look wrecked and I look wrecked and sure, you know.
But fair dues to you because, you're exposing yourself, aren't you? No, in that, like, I remember going and I was like, I was in my late 30s and I was in 2 feet of water and the guy who was teaching me how to swim had me in flippers. So there I was in flippers, right? And I had the goggles on and the hat and I was waiting for your man to come in 2 feet of water. And next thing, the 6 year old swam around me like one of those wind up toys in a bath.
I look like I'm from Danger Mouse.
Like, but you leave your dignity at the door.
No, you totally leave your dignity. And then there's like, you know, there's like a young coach who knows your son. Oh, hi.
Yeah.
Hiya, what are you doing here? I'm going to can't swim. And he's going, really? Oh. And you know he's kind of going, is that for real? Yeah. And like, my little sister really annoyed me last week. She said, why can't you swim? What's wrong with you? People are cruel, but I put manners on that one too. But anyway, Shinshkela, I suppose for me, it's I'll see how I go. But I'm hoping, like, do you think I can be able to swim the whole length down to the deep end by week 5?
Right, well, you're going to come back. That'd be a huge achievement.
All right.
So you must have some swimming skills if you hope to be able to do that in 5 weeks.
No, I haven't even gone down the whole length of the pool yet, even with the boards. I have the 2 floaty boards.
Yes, yeah. You want to be able to swim the full length, a 25-metre pool.
Yeah,
after just 5 weeks of learning. That's ambitious, yeah. Maybe you're a quick learner.
I'm not a quick learner. I'm as stupid as the next person. But come here. I'm not trying to get into the 40 foot and look like all those great women down there every morning. I'm not trying to swim with the seals here. I just thought I could get down to the deep end, no? And out of my depth, just for us. Oh, I don't know. Well, looking at your team out there.
Took
so
me
much
9
confidence
months.
Coming from
tell
them
Blonde, tell Blonde swimming is a confidence thing, like driving or cycling a bike, baby steps. Or should that be
they're
baby
right.
swims?
I need to be patient.
That's Billy.
That person's right.
And to get over the fear, I was told to go home and put my head in a sink of water. The other thing you can do is, I don't know if your coach is telling you to do it, but stand, you know, at the side of the pool and just put your head in and take it up and put it, just to get used to it. That's another. Well done, Blondet. Of course you'll swim if you keep going to the lessons.
Oh, I will keep going.
Margaret,
now.
She can't swim. I was about that age, 50, when I learned to swim. Take your time. Wear the goggles. I was very nervous also. Keep at it. You'll do it. I can swim now and I'm delighted, says Anne. I learned to swim in my 60s. I can do it all now, except for turning around after doing a lane. I panic and go under the water. And I learned to swim by watching people swimming in the pool. My parents couldn't afford the lessons. I'm now married to a swim teacher and he told me I have an excellent swimming technique. So they just sat at the side of the pool and watched other people. I learned to swim when I was 15 and it was embarrassing. I was in the same lane as all the kids, but it was worth it in the end. Great to get into the sea when you're on holidays. I can't swim. Nearly drowned myself and others. I'm 70 now, still afraid of the water.
Aww.
And Mick here, in my 60s now and can't swim stroke. Yet I have owned boats all my adult life.
Well, you know, there's a theory about that. Fishermen say, what's the point? But I think that's a bit of a pishrogy thing. You know, it's sort of, you know, it's not really, I don't think, like years ago when I was a small, they say in Connemara, you don't want to meet a redhead before you go out fishing, it's bad luck. And then someone says, did that go into your head? And I said, I don't think so. Like, all those things don't help now, you see.
Yeah, but that's just superstition.
I know.
I was younger, I fished for prawns on the Skerry's prawn boats for years. Oh. Go to the pool now 4 times a week and exercise. Walking and jogging in the pool. Hopefully by the summer, I'll be able to do a few strokes under my own steam. That's Mick in his 60s. And just started learning to swim for about the 5th time. I did have bad experience as a child. Someone close held my throat under bath water. Anyway, I started yesterday, got panicked, but the people teaching us were amazing and I think it might work this time. You got stories from the people in the class. A lot of people have bad
experiences. Oh, every single one of them. I nearly made one up because I felt so stupid that I didn't have one. They all had an experience. Oh, my brother held me down. Oh, I nearly drowned. I was small. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. Like everyone had a story. I didn't have any story. Not that I can remember. And I asked my mom, because I was with her this morning, I asked her, Mom, did I have any dodgy experience? She goes, no. She said, you didn't want to put your head under. That's I remember the teacher saying that.
I took up swimming lessons about 18 months ago. I'm in my 50s and I never learned to swim. I had an accident when I was 8 on the farm. I fell into a sheep dip and nearly drowned. Luckily, I survived, but it left me very nervous. So last year, I decided to give it a go. I thought a person could learn to swim in a six-week lesson session. Boy, was I wrong. Say, listen up. Everything took time, from putting my head under the water to actually moving on the water. It's slowly happening and I love it. I suppose I'm happy to be still learning at this stage of my life, and I think that this will open a whole new world for me.
I think, though, for me, listening to that, I can't presume, Ray, as you said, that I'll be able to do it after 5 weeks. But I also have to commit to not giving up after 5 weeks. Are you with me? I think this is my chance to stick with it and get it, do it properly. Because yes. I think if I give up, I'll be back where I was.
Why don't you swim backstroke? You don't have to put your face in the water, Eugene.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, yeah. No, he's right. But you still have to have the skill. Like, yeah. I mean, my thing is, I don't expect that if I fell off a boat in the middle of nowhere, that I'm going to save myself. But I just want to not panic. So if I get help, I don't pull the person down with me. And I might hold myself up until I get help. Yeah. I'm not stupid. Most of us, even if we're good at swimming, I mean, with temperatures and everything, as you have an accident in the sea, you're going to have it. But it's just the idea of causing someone else's death. I mean, that's a very scary. But apparently, Kieran said, like, the first thing they used to teach you in lifeguard classes, punch the person nearly. You have to knock them out if they're panicking.
Just wondering if she practiced at home, putting her face in a dish of water. Let go of the fear. That's the second person who said that. Sink.
You see,
water,
do you know Halloween when you have the money in the apple and you know, you bob for apple? Bob and apple, is that what they call it? Do you know when you try, you know, you ever do that?
Yeah.
Well, I can do that.
No,
you go
there.
Figure. So what is that about?
Why is there embarrassment around not being able to swim? We can walk. We don't need to know how to swim. I suppose that's a fair enough question.
It's very deep.
Yeah.
Jeepers. Hello, philosophy there.
What pushed me into learning to swim was two things. Turning 40 and having children.
Not being able to save them, like, if something happened. Yeah. You see, that's an awful thing. But you see, I had Kieran, I had my backup.
Yeah.
And I never holidayed without him as such, you see. And now it's like driving abroad. You know this thing, driving abroad? Sure, he does it.
Yeah.
Asher, yeah, but you could do it if you want. Oh, I don't think I could. He'll do it. Like, it's all part of that. You'll get into it. It's habits.
I was 65 and I learned to swim. I can swim from the deep end up, but not the other way. Working on it. Yeah, you see, that's the thing. So I used to be like that. So they can swim out of the deep end because they know they're going to the shallow end.
Okay.
Now, they're still swimming 25 metres, but the thoughts of swimming from the shallow end to the deep end.
I could try that.
Yes.
I could try that.
Yeah, that's
okay.
I learned in my 60s, I went into the baby pool on my own for about 6 weeks to get used to putting my head underwater. Now I do 40 lengths 5 days a week, says Maeve. So there. And well done to Blonnet. I'm in my 50s and have a fear of water, nearly drowned when I was small, but I kept at it. Learned to swim across the pool, but failed to thread water in the deep end, but won't give up. That's my thing. I can't thread water.
No, weirdly, I can do that.
Oh, can you?
Yeah.
I
can do that because Kieran made me learn that once we were away. I can do that a bit, but not really that. But the other thing that I think is strange, very, very strange, is that I don't think people, how will I say it? I thought my generation were the worst. I think we're quite bad. Do you not think younger people are better swimmers, like under 20s and...
Yeah,
I think they did more of it. There was more of a promotion on swimming.
Maybe there was. And I think, like me, the fact that I couldn't swim, I made sure that my kids could swim. You were probably the same.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Yes. I think younger people, in fairness, can swim better. But another thing I'll throw out to you. People think they can also swim better. Oh, I can swim. But you ask them to swim and you'll see a lot wrong with their strokes. They don't swim that well.
There is a statistic here just when you're talking about their own children. This is 1 in 3 children can't swim. This is the UK and maybe ours are similar. And 1 in 5 adults can't swim. So
it's more than 1 in 5 from the people I talk to.
Yes, and from the text we're getting in today.
It's more than 1 in 5.
Yeah, come back into us then. So it's I've just worked out it's Monday evenings.
Monday evenings, yeah. Monday evenings. And it's either a good... You see, you're right about the energy and the will and everything. It is 8 to 9. But to be honest with you, you know, I can sort of do most of the other things by 8, you know, everyone's back in and everyone's being collected or whatever, you know, the usual hoo-ha, blah, blah, blah. And
Parental duties.
Why are they getting worse? They're getting older. You go figure. Either I've spoiled them rotten or the world is cruel because they'll never leave me. Like, they'll never be able to afford to leave. Not me. They don't love me. They love me. They don't particularly like me half the time. But you are stuck with... You have hot water.
We're into domestics again.
No, but we have hot water. We have hot water. The fridge is full. And that's my life.
Yeah. No rent.
Yeah.
Well, why would they leave?
I'll start charging.
Right. We'll talk to you then in a few weeks. See how you're getting on.
Okay.
Blondie Gourmila Margot.
Tafoid's Rue 3.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Huge response to Blondet and her swimming lessons. Just listening to the swimming discussion, I'm in the exact same position as her. She's given me inspiration to go for lessons. Go on. When I was learning to swim, I stood in the deep end and put my head in the water and used to practice turning my head and the breathing. That's what I did while standing. If you don't like looking unusual in the pool, it helped. So there's loads more. We'll get back to that, and Blondet will visit us before the end of her 5-week sessions. That's it from us. Mary Wilson's on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening.
The Ray Darcy Show. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.